from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. President Donald Trump's immigration enforcement tactics have come into greater public scrutiny, especially within the halls of Congress. And one person who will have a vote on whatever the outcome ends up being is Representative Bob Onder, a Republican from St. Charles County. Onder joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about what's not being talked about during the immigration debate in Washington, as well as several pieces of legislation that he filed in his first year in office. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democrat country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oratory over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us from Washington, D.C., he has finally fulfilled his lifelong dream of becoming a member of Congress, the representative for Missouri's 3rd Congressional District we have today.
Bob Onder.
First of all, welcome back to the show. It is a very busy Tuesday.
Great to be back.
Thank you. It's a busy Tuesday in D.C., so I will dispense with the small talk for now. As Congress and the president negotiate a spending bill over the Department of Homeland Security, a lot of Republicans are balking over placing any sort of restrictions or accountability toward ICE or Border Patrol. I know Democrats want to do that. And before I ask my next question, how are you kind of like coming into this debate? Even though that we should put a caveat here, Bob Onder does not have control over the outcome. It's probably going to be the leadership of the parties and the president. But like, what is sort of your general feeling going into the next week or two?
Yes. Well, I think we have to step back and ask why we didn't pass that 12 out of 12 appropriations bills. And that is because, Democrats were concerned about immigrations and customs enforcement and how they have conducted themselves in terms of detention and immigration proceedings. I like many are very disturbed at what has gone on in Minneapolis and elsewhere around the country. But I think the root of the problem is this problem of sanctuary city and sanctuary state jurisdictions. You'll notice you don't have this immigration enforcement related violence going on in Texas or Florida or Missouri. You have it going on in blue states that tend to be sanctuary jurisdictions. And the reason for that is very simple, that if a criminal illegal alien, and again, we're talking here about people with final orders of removal from immigration judges, if that person is in detention, is in the county jail, and ICE issues a detainer, asks that that person be transferred to ICE, that happens very peacefully, very uneventfully. But in jurisdictions, sanctuary jurisdictions that don't cooperate with federal immigration authorities, the ICE agents have to go find those people. And that can be a very dangerous proposition. This is why in 2008, we had the foresight to outlaw sanctuary cities as part of House Bill 1549, which actually was my bill that Matt Blunt signed into law. So I think there are some reforms that Republicans can live with. Most law enforcement authorities think that body cameras are probably a good idea. If anything, they tell law enforcement's side of the story. And actually, the appropriations bill for Homeland Security did include money for body cameras. But yeah, I think it could be this could all result in a shutdown if the parties don't come to the table.
So when you said that there were certain things about Minneapolis that disturbed you, I'm going to name three things that disturbed me. That includes ICE or Border Patrol agents asking people for immigration papers because they had accents, ICE parading a half-naked legal immigrant out in the cold and then riding him around for an hour before dropping him back off, and also video of a number of ICE officers violently tearing a legal U.S. citizen out of her car, even though she said over and over again that she was autistic and was probably having a sensory meltdown when that situation happened. Are those the type of things you were disturbed by?
Yeah, I don't know the details of the particular episodes that you're describing there, but sure. I mean, those things, would be inappropriate. And I think that's why, President Trump is bringing in a different management, to ICE. I think Tom Holman is a 40-year veteran of immigration enforcement, is the right person for the job. I think there are reforms that we can live with. I think most of them are more managerial rather than statutory. But really, I think the fact is that at the end of the day, the Democrats, if they do shut down the Department of Homeland Security on Friday, they won't be defunding ICE or Customs and Border Patrol. We provided plenty of funding for those agencies last summer in the Working Families Tax Cut Act. They'll be defunding Coast Guard, FEMA at a time when we are having severe winter storms, and TSA. So, I hope we can come to the table and get the government open, keep it open.
I'm glad you mentioned your 2008 bill, because before this interview, I read through the summary again, and you're correct. It banned sanctuary cities. My favorite joke is whenever I see, I think I've actually made this reference to the joke before on the show, but whenever I see a Missouri politician with an ad saying, I'm going to ban sanctuary cities, and I'm like, yeah, all you have to do is exist and not do anything because they're already banned. But the other thing that your bill did was require E-Verify for government contractors. And from looking at a map, there are a lot of states, both red and blue, that don't have any requirements whatsoever to check the immigration status of employees. And I think really this entire ICE situation in Minneapolis has really kind of de-escalated or kind of taken away the whole idea that maybe if there were more strict penalties on employers employing undocumented immigrants, maybe there would be less of an economic incentive. Should that be talked about more, about making E-Verify required for every state?
Well, yeah, I think my 2008 bill required E-Verify for public employers and then public contractors, recipients of government contracts. Yeah, and I think that was an entirely reasonable proposition. And yes, I do think we do need enforcement of immigration laws in all areas. The administration is concentrated on criminal illegal aliens, which is really the more difficult area of immigration enforcement to accomplish because of that issue that you're dealing with. Sometimes violent criminals. Barack Obama was called by some open borders advocates the deporter in chief. He deported, I believe, about 700,000 undocumented aliens during his 8 years. But his administration concentrated really more on employment, workplace enforcement. I really do think we need to do both. We need to remove the magnets for illegal immigration. And the biggest magnet of all is employment and even amnesty. But again, there's good reason to, with the presence of violent criminal illegal alien drug gangs, there's good reason to focus also on those illegal aliens who have broken the law.
Before we go to the next issue, one thing that I think has been sticking in my craw for a while is that, again, one of the things that's not being talked about a lot is that there probably aren't enough immigration judges to not only deport people that you mentioned who have committed crimes and who came into the country illegally, but also people with, I would classify, legitimate asylum claims that need to be adjudicated. And there's often years-long waits for both of these things. I understand mm-hmm. this is not going to be part of this negotiation, but what has been kind of the what has stopped like Republicans and Democrats from coming to some sort of agreement of saying there's going to be like 3,000 more immigration judges and we're going to deal with the backlog and we're going to deal with some of these edge cases a lot quicker, so people just aren't in limbo, whether they deserve asylum or whether they should be deported because they committed a crime?
Yeah, well, you're right about the need for more immigration judges. And that's actually a big part of the $170 billion in the One Big Beautiful Bill last summer for immigration enforcement. A big chunk of that is going to hire more immigration judges, because you're right about the backlog of asylum cases. We have a backlog of about 2.2 million asylum applicants in the United States. And then we have about, did I say billion, 2.2 million.
Yeah, I don't think we have I don't think everybody on earth is asyluming here, but continue.
We're only, our population's only 335 million. Then we have another backlog of 1.2 million temporary protected status individuals, some of whom have been in the United States. These are usually folks whose countries were struck by hurricanes or worse, earthquakes or natural disasters. Some of those folks have been in the country for up to 20 years. So we have a big immigration backlog. And yes, we do, and we have directed more resources to that area of immigration courts and immigration judges.
So let's talk about a couple bills that you have put forward. Let's talk about the less controversial one first, although I'm sure you're going to think both of them are not controversial, but you'll understand the context. I think one of the bills that you've sponsored deals with the aftermath of that horrible helicopter plane crash that happened in Washington, D.C. Can you just talk a little bit about that and what you're trying to accomplish there?
Yeah. So on January 29th of 2025, a commuter jet operated by American Airlines collided with an Army helicopter, a Black Hawk, over the Potomac. The plane was on the final approach to Reagan National Airport. That accident of 67 people were killed. That accident brought to the fore a number of structural problems that resulted in that tragedy. A big one was lack of coordination between military flights and civilian flights. In fact, these military helicopter flights, and this was just a routine training mission, up and down the Potomac brought them right under the landing glide path of Reagan National Airport, which is really unacceptable. The communications between the military and civilian air traffic control were not good. The helicopter was about 200 feet too high. And the helicopter had not used a piece of safety equipment known as ADS-B, which is a transponder, something that would broadcast its position to air traffic control and to the landing plane. They had not used that technology, even though the Black Hawk was equipped with that technology, for 730 days. So they just weren't using it at all. So we filed the Rotor Act, which is a bipartisan bill. It passed the Senate. Senator Ted Cruz is the sponsor. It passed the Senate unanimously. And it would require the use of ADS-B for all aircraft, civilian or military operating busy airspace. It would require more coordination between the military and civilian aviation. And really, most of all, would conduct safety reviews to make sure things like that tragedy don't happen again.
You have also sponsored legislation that would basically allow people to sue over receiving hormone therapy, puberty blockers, or gender affirmation surgery as minors, among other things. I have a lot of questions on this, but unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time. But I guess the one that comes to mind is, why should the federal government standardize, like, whether there can be litigation over this, rather than just have a state-by-state basis, which we have now?
Yeah, you know, obviously we have a lot of federal laws that touch on all 50 states. As long as that bill affects interstate commerce, that's always the, you know, the standard, whether it fits under that so-called Commerce Clause of the Constitution. And, you know, certainly patients, you know, cross state lines for this sort of treatment. But ultimately, this is about protecting kids, and we believe kids in all 50 states should be protected. Children are too young to consent to life-altering care that commits them to a lifetime of, say, cross-sex hormones or treatment for complications of surgery. You know, of these gender-confused children, if you leave them alone, if you support them with counseling, with psychological care, 70 to 95% of them end up by identifying as the sex that they were born. But if they go down this route of puberty blockers, of cross-sex hormones, and then surgeries, many, many of those children will live to regret it, and most of them will suffer a lifetime of medical complications, from osteoporosis to infertility to skeletal system abnormalities, neurocognitive problems. So really, the United States should join other developed countries such as the UK, such as Sweden, such as Finland, and recognize that at this point, this remains experimental therapy, that the risk very well may outweigh the benefits, and we should take a step back and really wait until there's more data in before we do any more harm to children.
So at the risk of playing whataboutism, but I am going to play whataboutism here. Your press release states that numerous forms of gender-affirming care are not rooted in science, are supported by peer-reviewed research. But isn't it hypocritical for conservatives to lean on a lack of FDA approval or studies here, when a lot of Republicans said take X drug for COVID when that hadn't been approved by the FDA? And you had the president of the United States stand at a podium say, don't take Tylenol or your kid might get autism, even though the studies on that are way too premature to make statements like that. Like, isn't there a lack of consistency here?
Yeah. So I think there are a couple of things at work here. One is that that we physicians, I am a physician, as you know, we prescribe drugs off label all the time, and there's nothing wrong with with that. Say a blood pressure medicine might be used for a heart condition to lower blood pressure. That's very common. The problem with so-called gender affirming care or gender rejecting care is that we're imposing on kids therapies that they are far too young to consent to, things that can alter their health and well-being for the rest of their lives if they go down that path. Whereas, things like ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine for COVID, works or not works, the risk of those therapies was really de minimis. Again, whether it worked or didn't work, you know, it's an off-label use of a drug that was really very safe. But you know, once you cut a 15-year-old girl's breasts off, she will never have her breasts again, and that's really the concern.
So right now it is February 10th, 2026. There is currently a court case going on about whether the MAP that was passed in 2022 is in effect or 2025. And the impact on you, for instance, is really quite substantial. Your district changes dramatically under the new MAP. It looks like our favorite district ever, the 9th district, which is no longer exists, but included a lot of Northeast and Central Missouri. I guess at this point, do you expect to be running in the old district or the new district? And I ask this question knowing that you have no real control over what the judges are going to do. But I also know that you were around in 2017. There were signatures turned in to overturn Right to Work. There was not a millisecond of time where Right to Work was ever in effect in Missouri. And I'm really struggling to figure out why the new MAP would be in effect when basically the same sequence occurred, where there was referendum signatures put forward, the law was frozen. What do you make of all this, and what are your expectations going into November with this admittingly confusing legal situation before you?
Well, it is a confusing situation, but the Constitution gives the county clerks until June to certify the signatures, and then gives the Secretary of State until July. So it stands to reason that the law in question wouldn't be frozen. The law was passed by the constitutional procedure of passing the House and the Senate and being signed by the governor. So, you know, I think if the referendum ultimately goes no and the new MAP is rejected, we would have a situation where I'd be running in and representing a new district for 2 years, and then we'd go back to the old district. So it's really confusing. That's why I really think that Attorney General Hanaway's lawsuit that MAPs really, it doesn't make sense that MAPs be subject to referendum. I think that lawsuit has some merit, but there's no question it's confusing for the voters and even for the candidates.
Yeah,
at this point.
And that being said,
I'll be going to all those Lincoln days.
Yeah, I was just going to say as a final point before I let you go, the new district is one of the few that is less Republican and could eventually be a competitive district if St. Charles County becomes 50-50. Which has been sort of the white whale of Democratic Missouri politics since both of us started 20 years ago. So I'm not going to say that's going to happen next cycle, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon, Congressman. And for anybody who wants to keep tabs on what you're doing in Washington, D.C., how can they follow you either on social media or your congressional website?
Yeah, my congressional website is onder.house.gov. And my social media is at Bob Onderbo.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.